On this week's programme, a conversation with Jerry Lynn Johnson. The highly regarded local conductor embarks on her second season as music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra, the ensemble she founded 2 years ago on Thursday. David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to the Bang on a Can Marathon. The contemporary music ensemble embarks on a 10-hour uninterrupted performance as part of the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival tomorrow. And we speak with Robert Whitman. He writes of his years as head of the FBI's art crime team in Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Jerry Lynn Johnson, the former assistant conductor of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, is music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra. Touting a roster of culturally diverse musicians, the orchestra plays free concerts to raise awareness and appreciation of classical music. Now entering its second season, Johnson founded Black Pearl in the hope that through connections with other arts organizations in Philadelphia, her ensemble would encourage audiences beyond spectatorship to participation in the musical experience. Despite starting the ensemble in the midst of a tanking economy, things have so far worked out very well for Jerry Johnson. Audience and critical response to Black Pearl has been very positive, and the ensemble is now collaborating with institutions such as the Free Library of Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Orchestra. It will also be part of next spring's Philadelphia International Arts Festival. I spoke with Jerry Lynn Johnson ahead of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra's season-opening concert on Thursday at the Baptist Temple at Temple University.
You know, I think in retrospect, partially the timing may have been part of our success. I think a lot of arts organizations, and particularly classical music, were going through a rough time, probably a lot of rethinking about core missions and how they operate as businesses. And so I think partially the timing of our organization around diversity, around a different way of doing business, I think was probably a good thing, kind of a cloud with a silver lining.
That which makes it a very good idea is that artistically in your first season, you really did get it right. It hung on that.
We did. I have to say a lot of the credit goes to my fantastic musicians. We've been able to create really exciting partnerships with some of the really fantastic chamber ensembles in the city, like the Dalí Quartet and Rodney Mack Philadelphia Big Brass, among others. And I think that goes to the quality of our individual players as well as the ensemble itself, and the fact that we have a lot of fun performing as well. So I think the quality of the musicianship as well as the emotional excitement that we bring to the performance has really won over audiences.
There were some risks last season. You were doing some lesser well-known work, but you were taking on Standard Rep, the War Horses, and everybody knows them, and everybody knows when they're good, and if it hadn't been good, it was.
Well, I guess that was probably due to my confidence in my musicians. When you're starting out as an arts organization, it is really important that you have credibility artistically as well as strive to achieve your mission. And part of our mission was to do those lesser known works by African American and Latin American composers that are wonderful pieces, but aren't just as well known in the mainstream. And so alongside of that, we wanted to show that not only were we able to perform new and exciting works, but that we had the musical chops to perform things like Beethoven.
Looking forward to the upcoming season, what lessons were learned from last year in terms of your artistic choices for the coming season?
Keep it up. I mean, I think this season we've continued the pattern of pairing Standard War Horse repertoire with lesser-known pieces by composers of various backgrounds. For example, our upcoming concert for September 16th, which is the beginning of Hispanic Heritage Month in general, but specifically September 16th marks the 200th anniversary of Mexico's independence from Spain, as well as the centennial of their revolution. So it's a major holiday for Mexican Americans and Mexicans as well. And so part of our programming there was to really celebrate a lot of great Mexican composers like Silvestre Revueltas, Moncayo, and Ponce, and do a lot of their works that are really wonderful pieces, but we're also doing Beethoven's Leonor No. 3 Overture, which at first glance doesn't seem to have a lot of connection to Mexico until you look at the story of the opera itself and realize that it's about the plight of a Spanish political prisoner and his wife who disguises herself as a man to find him and rescue him. So there's these kind of programmatic connections between the pieces, and that's really exciting.
There were three strands to how you were going to encourage diversity in the concert hall. One was going to be programmatically, sure, that you've done on the stage in terms of the makeup of the musicians that you've done. Sure. Has the third strand been successful? Are you seeing more diversity in the audience?
Absolutely. I have to say we have been fully embraced, and I have to emphasize this, by the entire Philadelphia community, and that really was our goal. Obviously, we want to attract more African-American and Latin-Americans to the concert hall, but we've really, because of the quality of our performances and the diversity of repertoire that we perform, we've been able to bring traditional concert audiences as well as new audiences into the hall. African-American and Hispanic service organizations have really come out to support us, and we are just so thrilled and excited about that. We want to continue that in the future.
During the heyday of Hollywood, it's said that the studio orchestras were made up of classically trained, top of the game, a lot of them Eastern European string players, and brass and percussion sections from the big bands. And that's why you had this particular sound in Hollywood. Is there the possibility that because there will be differences in the musical backgrounds of the people on the stage, that the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra will have a particular sound because of that, do you think?
You know, it's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, we are very keen to develop our own sound. And I think what's interesting is, you know, our musicians come from a variety of backgrounds. We actually have musicians who came through the El Sistema program, which of course has been making quite a lot of headway in this country. And so they come from a background where this music is in their blood. It's something they've grown up with all of their lives. And all of our musicians, I think, have a variety of other performance interests in addition to classical music, whether it's Venezuelan, you know, tango, or say you have from Piazzolla, Rodney Mack, Philadelphia Big Brass, there's a wide variety of repertoire.
So they can swing.
So they can swing. And I think the ability to draw very naturally from a variety of different musical heritages is what's going to make every performance that we do, depending on the genre, depending on the repertoire, very authentic. It's not going to feel like we really have to teach ourselves how to, you know, do these Latin rhythms, because it's in our blood. It's something that we just know how to do. And all of our musicians come with such incredible training. Curtis, Juilliard, Peabody, you know, we've just got great musicians. So we feel that as time goes by, and as we're able to add concerts to our concert season and we perform more regularly together, we are really going to be able to create our own unique sound. That's something I'm very excited about.
But you yourself come from a very traditional Western classical music background. Does the idea of all this Latin and jazz type music happening on the stage, is that scary for you to control?
No, you know, it's not scary for me to control. I do rely very heavily on my musicians. I think kind of gone are the days of this sort of dictatorial rule of conductors. And I think part of what makes the musicians buy into the project, buy into the orchestra, is the fact that they have a great deal of input. Now, I'm still the conductor. I'm still making, you know, all of these decisions. But when I have questions about, you know, how should we be playing this? What's the inflection of this phrase? You know, I go to the musicians. This is their country. This is their heritage. They are the experts. And so each one of the musicians is able to contribute their own unique individual gifts to the sound. And then, you know, it's my job to really marshal those forces and create a focal point for the sound that will then govern the entire ensemble.
When we spoke almost exactly a year ago, I asked you how you would like to be looking back on that year. And everything you said then, you've pretty much said now. So you checked the boxes, you achieved what you wanted to achieve in the first year. If I ask you the same question a year from now, how will the chamber orchestra have gone forward? What's the ambition for this year? What's the changes you want to see?
The changes I want to see for this year, I want to not have any concerts canceled due to weather. I mean, if that's not too much to ask. We were really disappointed about our February concert being canceled. But I think one of the things that we want to continue to do is expand our presence throughout, I think, the whole Delaware Valley. We were accepted onto the PennPAT roster, Pennsylvania Performing Arts on Tour. So that's a step in the right direction. I just think it's important that we, as ambassadors for classical music, we take our look and our sound to as many places as possible. And that includes, you know, out on the main line in places, over to New Jersey, over to Delaware if possible, even up to New York if we can get a chance to go up there. I think, you know, again, more concerts. Again, we're a very new ensemble. Times are still difficult economically. We certainly understand that. our first concert this season is again free and open to the public. We are sticking with that for our opening concert. That's extremely important. Our ticket prices are very, very reasonable. Again, we really want everyone who loves classical music to be able to afford this. And so I think moving forward, like I said, being able to tour our orchestra throughout the state and throughout the region, and also to add additional concerts to our season, that's going to be a mark of significant growth for us, in that, you know, we're giving the people of Philadelphia something that they really value.
Jerry Lynn Johnson, music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra. The ensemble plays its season opening concert on Thursday at the Baptist Temple at Temple University. The concert is a celebration of Mexican music in recognition of the Mexican Bicentennial.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Just the name of the Bang on a Can Marathon suggests some sort of clangorous new music inferno, one that may even exceed its stated 10-hour length. But there's a reason why these one-day festivals have become an annual institution of sorts in downtown Manhattan, and have been exported to Amsterdam, Baton Rouge, and now Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns was told to expect something much more nuanced than, as one of the marathon founders once described it, a bunch of composers banging on a can.
The Bang on a Can headquarters in the Fort Greene section of Brooklyn confirms and confounds expectations. It's so plain, it could be the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. The computers are everywhere, averaging about 3 monitors for every employee, all of whom are fashionably thin. A Broadway show album is stuffed in the corner. The score to a piece titled Trance is spread on the table. Party lights are draped overhead, ready to be pressed into service. Obviously, the connecting principles behind Bang on a Can are ideas rather than superficialities. Or maybe the years of producing such musically heterogeneous marathons since 1987 have eradicated any need for the usual artistic connections, at least for Kenny Savelson, who runs Bang on a Can.
You know, after some hours of all this music kind of side by side, you know, just the normal way of listening seems to melt away, and the normal associations you may have for independently reviewing the experience you're having or the music, you know, kind of disappears, and you start to hear everything on a much freer, I think. And it leaves you with a much more almost natural way to, you know, judge each piece individually.
It's an approach to listening that doesn't ask why, but why not? How else could you approach a program that includes Steve Reich's drumming, arrangements of music from pop star Bjork, the severe Dutch minimalist Louis Andriessen, and, in something that could give the marathon a Philadelphia accent, the extraterrestrial jazz of the Sun Ra Orchestra, whose songs like Love from a Faraway Planet suggest how enjoyable a vacation from one's own sphere can be.
To us, they all go together perfectly naturally.
Bang on a Can co-founder Julia Wolf.
There's definitely a dynamism that we're looking for by putting these things back to back, but they're all very inventive, in our minds, original, and pushing boundaries within the world that they're in.
The idea of moving this feast to Philadelphia tomorrow has been on a number of minds for a while. The Bang on a Can All-Stars, the marathon's house band, has played successful one-off concerts at the Kimmel Center. Co-founder David Lang has had a series of successful premieres with the Mendelssohn Club and The Crossing. The Asphalt Orchestra, a Bang on a Can offshoot that wants to be an avant-garde marching band, played its own transcriptions of Frank Zappa in a surprise performance last summer at 30th Street Station. And Wolf can't help having Philadelphia on the brain, considering that she comes from nearby Montgomeryville and was once one of those teenage denizens of South Street.
It's a beautiful old historic city. It's a very different feel. In a way, it's more radical to bring this into that environment.
The logistics of producing a 10-hour concert with 12 different performing entities, also including So Percussion and the indie rock group Normal Love, aren't easy, especially if every group is assured of a sound check. Live Arts Festival producing director Nick Stuccio needed to buy out World Cafe Live for tonight so that everybody would be ready to go tomorrow. That pushed the production cost up to $125,000, and it could go higher if spontaneity leads to overtime.
I do get a little sweaty when I hear about over 100 musicians and singers descending on this little building. And I think also built into these things is the unknown, which I think is good. There are moments where various artists will join other artists on stage. I'm now getting the sense that from Banging the Can, like, oh yeah, didn't we tell you sometimes it runs really long? If the party's going and the music's great, I will authorize a little OT.
The idea of the marathon began when Wolf, her husband Michael Gordon, and good buddy David Lang migrated from Yale to downtown Manhattan. In 1987, they decided to put on an extended concert of their own music, as well as music that they wanted to hear, regardless of genre or school of composition. The name for both the marathon and the composer collective they formed embodied a lot about who they are. It's too long to be snazzy and too ambiguous to allow categorization. Problem is, some potential funders confused Bang on a Can with the noisy off-Broadway show Stomp.
One year we actually couldn't get funding from a foundation because of the name. They're like, oh yeah, we got it this far, but we really can't get it past our board. We really can't fund something called Bang on a Can. So we thought that was, well, kind of sad, but it got also kind of funny. And also people at times, you know, I guess especially in the early years, expected to be percussion music or just percussion music. And we actually have had a few cans. We've had a few pieces with cans, and that was always kind of fun. But I think that, you know, part of the idea was to get rid of any sense of formality or a name that somehow is official or intimidating in any way.
This belief in unity among individuals is something that this Bang on a Can trio also practices intensively. The first part of the marathon is going to be dominated by an hour-long oratorio titled Shelter, composed by all three of these very different personalities. Ever the minimalist, Wolf likes to take the tiniest musical cell and drill into it until she finds more musical possibilities than anybody thought possible. Michael Gordon loves layers and is best known for creating the classic cult film Dicasia. And while some composers are inspired to write a piece based on, oh, say, Walt Whitman poetry, Gordon is more likely to zero in on the final seconds of the Beatles song Strawberry Fields Forever for a piece that he wrote titled I Buried Paul. David Lang won the Pulitzer Prize for The Little Match Girl Passion, a choral work that juxtaposes the famous Hans Christian Andersen tale with Bach's St. Matthew Passion. He also likes to set lists of things, litanies on more exalted days, all of which came together in this oratorio that explores different concepts of, well, shelter.
I leave my shoes at the door.
One of the movements Julia Wolf wrote is about porches.
There was a time when porches were really common and everyone would be sitting on their porch drinking lemonade, whatever, and how little by little the porch would become enclosed, first with screens and then eventually with walls. We didn't have a porch. Not really a porch. I mean, there was sort of like a fake porch in the front, I guess you'd say. We had a patio. So I guess my next piece should be patios. That would be fun. A lot of the discussion and the creation of the structure of the piece happens before we write a note. So we're talking about what makes it a whole and how the pieces fit together. And we're all pretty hard on ourselves, so I think we struggle till we find what's right. We're very frank with each other in that way, and that's part of the fun.
In a recent Bang on a Can podcast, Shelter conductor Brad Lubman describes in detail what it looked like at the first rehearsal.
You know, you end up with a work of art that perhaps it just couldn't have been conceived by only one or two of those artists. And, you know, one had the sense that this is a living, breathing organism, this work of art, and that it's not like any one particular person says, okay, I'm sorry, but I wrote it this way, and it must be this way, otherwise it's ruined.
What a repudiation this is of the still lingering 19th century idea of the lone wolf composer, the bearer of musical truth that demands a kind of respect that can also create unwanted distance with audiences. Is it possible that Bang on a Can is doing more than assembling a lot of unlikely pieces, but changing the entire social construct around serious new music? Making it something that's fun, doesn't necessarily demand long explanations or extended contemplation, and for listeners is more of a communal than introspective journey? Maybe we'll know a midnight from now.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Bang on a Can Marathon takes place tomorrow from 2 p.m. to midnight at the World Cafe Live in University City, Philadelphia. It's part of the Live Arts Philly Fringe Festival. Robert K. Whitman spent 20 years as an FBI special agent. His early training in music and Eastern art and antiques made him ideally suited to investigating art crimes. Assigned to the Philadelphia Field Division, he was instrumental in solving many high-profile arts and antiquities crimes, including thefts from the Rodin Museum, the Penn Museum, and the Pennsylvania Historical Society. Over the course of his career, Whitman estimates he had a hand in the recovery of more than $225 million worth of stolen art and cultural property, and in the prosecution and conviction of numerous art thieves, both in the US and abroad. He details many of these investigations and his own personal struggles in his memoir, Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. I met with Robert Whitman at his home in the Philadelphia suburbs earlier this week. Despite the fact that even as a young boy you wanted to be in the FBI, your eventual route there was rather circuitous. The experience you had before going into the Bureau somewhat contributed to you eventually having this interest in solving art crimes.
Right. Well, you know, what had happened was my dad was very much interested in art and antiques. He was in Japan right after the Second World War during the Korean War, and he met my mother. And my father was collecting antiques at that time in Japan, and he brought many back to the States with him and got involved in the antiques business. And I kind of grew up around that whole setting, you know, with the art and antiques. And as a result, it wasn't so much I learned about antiques as much as I learned about the business of art and antiques. And that's really what is important when you do undercover work, trying to recover these paintings. You know, you can learn the art history, but you can't learn how to do business. I was also a classical music aficionado. I loved piano music. And even in college, when I was in college, my first year in college, I was thinking about being a performance major for piano. And, you know, as a result, I fell in love with all the classics. It kind of went hand in hand.
You went and learned more about how to look at art, though, at the Barnes Foundation.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, what happened was when I was first transferred to Philadelphia in 1988, I was transferred to the Property Crime Squad. And the very first case I was given with my partner, Bob Bazin, was a theft of the crystal ball from the University of Pennsylvania Museum. Bob and I investigated that case. We were lucky. It took us almost 2 years, but we actually were able to recover the piece, and we got it back. And right at that time, again, there was another heist at the Rodin Museum that was ongoing. So it was kind of serendipitous. You know, I wasn't planning on being in the art theft, art crime investigation business, but when I got to Philadelphia, the first two cases that I was involved with was the Rodin theft and the crystal ball theft.
It wasn't just, though, in Philadelphia. You were throughout the country. I believe you visited 21 countries in the course of your career as an art crimes investigator. Tell us some of the standout cases that you investigated.
It wasn't until later, around 1995 through 2010, that I started doing the international cases. Some of the interesting pieces, the Bill of Rights, the copy that was stolen from North Carolina in 1865, one of only 14 original copies of the Bill of Rights. We recovered that when someone tried to sell that to the National Constitution Center. Another interesting case was a Rembrandt self-portrait valued at about $35 million that had been stolen at gunpoint from the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. That case took us almost 6 years to solve. In the end, we were able to recover that piece in an undercover operation in Copenhagen, Denmark. There have been many, many interesting cases. Another one was a battle flag, a Civil War battle flag that was carried in a battle by the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique, which was an African-American U.S. Army regiment. And in that battle of Port Hudson, I believe 4 to 5 people were shot out from under the flag. So it was considered to be a blood cloth. You know, what's interesting is that the value of that particular flag was about $30,000 on the open market. Of course, the Rembrandt was valued at $35 million that we spoke about. But, you know, the true value of the two pieces is not the financial. It's not the monetary. It's the cultural history and a cultural value. You know, what's worth more? You know, a regimental battle flag that symbolizes the end of slavery and freedom for, you know, a large segment of our population, or a painting that was done in 1630. Both are very valuable. Both are important, but they both have immense cultural value.
You narrate in the book the fact that the gentleman who tried to sell you the flag was one of the dumbest criminals you'd ever come across. Tell us about who were the more clever ones you came across.
You know, I wouldn't say they were clever. I think that the real art and art theft is the selling of the piece, not the stealing. All these individuals were good at stealing, okay? They were good criminals, put it that way. When I say good, I mean they were proficient in their chosen profession. Just for example, the guys who stole the Rembrandt, they went into the Swedish National Museum. They had machine guns. They put everybody on the floor. They had two car bombs go off on the main roads that led to the museum from the mainland. They made their getaway after stealing three paintings. There was two Renoirs and the Rembrandt in a speedboat. So, you know, were they proficient criminals? Yeah, they got away with it. But they got caught in the end because they tried to sell them. And in the end, they sell them to the police. You know, were they good criminals? No, most of them were not proficient. I mean, they were not smart or clever or charming. There's not many Pierce Brosnans out there in the crime world.
Right. You referred to the Thomas Crown Affair, but it's probably an ill representation of how artworks are stolen from museums. Mostly, they're inside jobs.
Well, about 88%, we did a study in the early 2000s, about 88% of museum heists that have been solved are perpetrated by someone involved or inside the museum. Now, when we say that, we don't mean that's just, you know, people who work there. It could be an interested collector, it could be an expert that's allowed into the museum, or it could be someone who works there. But 88% is a high percentage when you look at the situation that there's some type of insider content.
The Gardner Museum heist from 1990 is probably one of the greatest unsolved art thefts. Is it something that you still ponder, now retired from the FBI?
Oh, I ponder it, of course. It's my belief and in my opinion that the paintings are in France. I think that we were within maybe 2 weeks of recovering the Vermeer and the Rembrandt. The Vermeer is called the Concert. It's a masterpiece. It's the only Vermeer missing in the world. The Rembrandt was the storm over the Sea of Galilee. It's the only seascape Rembrandt ever did. I worked for almost 2 years in an undercover operation involving Miami, Boston, and Paris. And it's my belief that those paintings are still in Marseille, in the south of France.
In someone's collection?
Not so much in a collection. There are gangs in France that do these types of thefts. It's not the only thing they do. They're also involved in drug running. They're also involved in money laundering and murder. But they also steal art. And they do it for two purposes. One purpose is to try to sell it. If they can't sell it, they save it. And then what they use it for is get out of jail free cards. In other words, they can turn around at that point, negotiate some type of settlement when they get caught for other crimes, and use those paintings as negotiating chips. So, you know, these gangs are known to be doing that. There's a group called the La Brise La Mer in Marseille that are very much involved in these types of heists.
So you expect these paintings will show up at some point?
Yeah, I think the fact that we didn't get them back is, of course, a loss, but really the epic victory in that investigation, in my belief, is to know that they exist. They're not destroyed, you know, they still exist, and that gives you hope of the possibility and probability of recovering them.
Could you steal any painting?
Could I steal a painting?
Hmm.
You mean practically, I guess anyone could steal a painting. I would never do that.
With your specialized knowledge, could you walk into a museum and say, yes, I can have any one of these paintings based on my knowledge of how they're secured?
Sure, if I wanted to get caught.
Robert Whitman, his best-selling memoir, Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, is out now in hardback. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.